we go ahead and hire our wives and friends' wives. This isn't good, brothers and sisters. Let us above all be consistent in our policy, practice what we preach. While I believe in the fundamental right of everyone to work if they so desire, let us at first see that there is at least one paycheck in every home. Remember, over 30,000 unemployed in the province. You may be next included in this number. Would you like to see several paychecks coming into your neighbor's home and none in yours, as was the case in many instances during the last depression? Jimmy Abrams, New Westminster. Editor's note. RWA policy does not authorize union members to work for the exclusion of any person from employment because of sex or marital status. Our correspondent would be well advised to read up on what the IWA stands for, as well as on general trade union principles. For many years, the trade union movement has been fighting for the right of all people to employment and a living wage. What is needed is more jobs and shorter hours, not fewer jobs and longer hours. Which is the better, to fight for jobs for all or to fight for the exclusion of married women from industry? Of course, the proposal was rejected. Why shouldn't it be? To have done otherwise would have been a betrayal of every trade union principle, for the males of the human race cannot free themselves from exploitation until they have freed women from the social degradation of dependence on the males for the bread that goes in their mouths. Ask any well-informed woman. April 21st, 1948. So I thought that was quite interesting, because it's clear that the debate was taking place not only in the not only within the industry in terms of workers versus management, but within the union itself. At the end of the war, the government brought in Bill 39, which basically put very strong controls on the right to organize. And the way that the bill was defeated was through a strike of laundry workers on the island that generalized. That is, a lot of other unions went out in support of them. But also through a lot of lobbying by various non-labor groups. So one of the issues that the women's auxiliaries took up was this piece of legislation. And this is an article in the paper written by the women's auxiliary on Bill 39. And it's, I think, 1947, yeah. Out with Bill 39. Bill 39 is on the lips of a lot of people today. Why? Because Bill 39 proposes to do things that have been done only in the fascist countries, in Germany, Italy, and Japan. It was in those countries that the government interfered with the freedom of unions to carry on their own business, like taking a strike vote, and we know what happened after that. Bill 39 also allows heavy fines on unions, on union leaders, and on all unionists taking part in it. Quote, illegal strike. Can you remember any strike that wasn't termed illegal? The fines are so heavy that no union could pay them and keep going. Clearly, it is a measure to smash unions. Bill 39 also takes away the right to strike, a right won by working people through years of struggle and hardship, a right necessary to protect our wages and conditions. If working people allow this bill to remain on the statutes of British Columbia, it will open the door to wage cuts, to longer working hours, and to worsenings of conditions all around. How we bring up our children, what standard of living parents are able to provide for them, depends on wages and working conditions. Can we afford to have a Bill 39 that will mean wage cuts and wage increases are needed so desperately? Of course not, and women must pay just as much attention to Bill 39 as men, because we form half of the team looking after our homes, because we form half of the voting public. The job of repealing Bill 39 is a big one, and as our unions challenge this reactionary, union-wrecking legislation, we women must get busy and help them do it. Because women didn't work hard enough against Hitlerism in Germany, fascism was successful in coming to power. Canadian women must never bear that responsibility for anything like that, especially in BC. Bill 39 can be stricken from the records of BC, and with it, the first steps to a fascist Canada thwarted. Sound familiar at all?
Yes.
Incredible, eh? Provincial. It's provincial labor legislation.
Mm-hmm.
No, I think it was pretty bad. Yeah. Well, I have become convinced that they do study labor history, and that they do know that, for example, they study labor legislation. Here's some more.
Yeah.
And what has really been fought by the unions, and what has been successful in controlling, you know, union activity.
And also, when you draw up just generally,
right. Yeah, in England. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, this one is the article that I was talking about earlier about women in strikes, and it's basically arguing for women to support unions and the right to strike. But I find it quite interesting because I think it combines both a sense of women not necessarily being pro-union enough and needing to be convinced, but also some quite clear criticisms of the history of the trade union movement. And it's again 1947, and I think it's quite interesting for its time. Here we go. As women, oh, it's called Women in Strikes, and it's the women's corner that this is in. As women ourselves, sometimes we are ashamed of women. It is not so long ago that women and little children were working from dawn to dusk for barely enough to keep themselves alive. Trade unions have changed all that. They have set hours of work that permit men and women to see the sun, and child labor is a thing of the past. It took some years for men to see that it is to their advantage that women get equal pay with men for equal work, but now the men have seen the light. Apparently some women have not. At the moment, interest is set on two strikes where women and men are asking for higher wages and better conditions. One is in the Army and Navy Department Store in New Westminster. The other, the Western Crown Manufacturing Company, New Westminster, which makes woodenware and brooms. And then the heading, shame! Two women, wives of good IWA members, have crossed the Army and Navy picket line and are scabbing on their fellow workers. The fact that they, as wives of workers and as workers themselves, have benefited by the struggle of trade unionists through the years apparently counts for nothing. A delegation from the IWA has called on the husbands of these two women to see if they can use their influence to keep their wives from scabbing, but to no avail. Apparently, the men have no influence over their wives. Of course, there is something to be said for women, too. For many years, men resented women getting into industry and did not welcome them in trade unions. They refused to treat them as equals, and therefore the history of trade union struggles was largely unknown to the women. Unless we study the story of the past, the Tall Puddle martyrs and the Haymarket riots mean nothing to us. Indeed, we here in BC are apt to forget such recent events as the Nanaimo strike, the horrible affair at Corbin, and the Blubber Bay strike. Even the Vancouver post office riot seemed to have left little mark on the minds of the workers, except those workers who felt police batons and tear gas. In the event of an IWA strike, what position will the women folk of the striking workers take? Will they bellyache about strike pay and having their men under their feet all day? Or will they be good comrades in a fight that must go on if the workers and the children of the workers are to have full stomachs, decent homes, proper education, and leisure enough to be men and women and not just beasts of burden? Okay, I'm going to break here for a little while because there's more to read and there's some tapes I want to play. They also developed another column called Auxiliary News and Views. And what they usually would publish were little reports on how sublocal auxiliaries were doing, and then also key key articles that would deal with issues that the union was dealing with and that women were dealing with. So here's one on, "Now is the time to join your auxiliary," by Dorothy Richardson, who was president of the district that is the auxiliary for a while. "We are gradually becoming more auxiliary conscious throughout British Columbia, but we still need a larger membership. Come on, ladies, how about you joining the auxiliary too? We are going to need ladies auxiliaries now, more than ever before. The larger the membership, the better we will be able to help when called upon for aid. The world is progressing and we must progress with it. We have all read the news in the papers recently that the IWA is preparing to strike, if necessary, in logging camps, sawmills, shingle mills, and all woodworking plants. A strike of this type would tie up as many as 30,000 workers and paralyze BC's lumbering industry. We don't want this to happen, but it may. It happened in Windsor, and it can happen here. If such a strike should be called in BC, who is it that will have to make $1 stretch into two? The women. Yes, and it will be the women who will have to do their part on the picket lines as well." Here's another poem by Marge Croy, who became Marge Dalskog, and I'm actually going to play some of a tape from her later on. But she used to write under various pseudonyms for the Union paper, and she used to write wonderful fiction, in fact, but she used to publish under a man's name because she thought that people would have more credibility. Her story, she wrote anonymously or under a man's name, but this one's written in her name. "You can join. Is your husband in the union, or your brother, or your son? Good for him, he sees the wisdom of the fight that must be won. He knows that workers disunited haven't got much on the ball, so he turns out to the meetings at the local union hall, listens to the controversy, supports the move considered best. Why don't you attend one with him? You can do so as a guest. Though you can't sail on the big ship, since you haven't got a vote, there is one way you can join in, climb on board the auxiliary boat. Trim, seaworthy, she's a convoy, and first aid in time of war. Captain and crew are gallant fighters, but there's room for many more. You will be a union member, throw your weight behind the rest. Your sisters in your local want you, come out and help them do their best." And under auxiliary news and views, this is 46, and it's January 46, so it's right at the end of the war, which you can kind of tell from the feeling of that poem. They also have other articles about domestic life, taking care of your kids. They had recipes a lot as well, but I'm not going to read you any. Here's one on "A child's first school is right in the home." And it's taken from the mine worker, and the auxiliary in the IWA had quite a strong relationship with the International Union of Mine, Mill, and Smelter Workers Auxiliary. So they would trade articles and also meet together sometimes. So it's from "Wholesome Mental Hygiene for Children." "Child behavior problems should always be carefully considered and patiently worked out, but never allowed to worry the parent or the child. Worry complicates the problem. It is infinitely better not only to permit children to express their feelings, but to encourage them to do this, even though they may shock and dismay us. A mother often cannot believe her ears when her young son tells her, 'I don't like my new baby sister. I wish she had never come to our house.' The mother should be happy that her boy is telling her what is tucked away in his small heart. The jealousy of the new arrival is caused by the mistaken belief that his place is being usurped. The mother, however, often crossly replies, 'You don't mean what you say. You love your baby sister. If you don't, you are a naughty child.' The confidences cease. The boy henceforth keeps his thoughts to himself, and this form of repression is not wholesome. Often physical and emotional upheavals result from it. It is a mistake to brush aside a child's resentment with, 'You don't feel that way at all. That's wrong. Now run out and play, dear. When you come back into the house, you and mother will have other things to talk about. The time for helping is when the child is in the mood to confide. And then the article goes on to talk about childhood depression. It's interesting because you can see the effect of psychology and Freudianism, which really took off in the post-war period, on the kind of analyses of how to deal with children and how adult depression is rooted in childhood and not resolving those kinds of early conflicts. So, as a parent, we should do our best to prevent the beginning of these emotions. And if in spite of our care they do develop, we must seek unobtrusively to find the cause and then labor to counteract it. A wholesome mental hygiene is a valuable asset to any child, helping him daily in the growing up process. It has been said, some people grow up, others only grow older. That's very Freudian. A well-balanced mentality promises a normal, all-round growing throughout childhood and youth that will not be halted at the grown-up age, but will continue its intellectual and spiritual development as long as life shall last. Advice to mothers. In the 1946 strike, first there was an appeal to women on the basis of just being women, both auxiliary women and women in the union. They should come out and support the strike. But then later on, the articles argued that union women should be allowed to have time to focus on picketing, and that it was the role of wives and so on to provide the kind of auxiliary services around a strike situation so that the women who actually worked could be on the picket line. So here is an article on that. Dorothy Richards, then editor of the Women's Auxiliary page of the Lumber Worker and member of Local 107, says, quote, "If we don't get women members to back our men, we will have to take our women off important jobs to go out and organize the auxiliaries of all locals. Don't pull our girls off of the picket lines for auxiliary work," she pleaded. The Vancouver local, which meets the second and fourth Tuesday of every month at the Holden Building, has established a coffee canteen for the workers at headquarters. They have a representative who meets with the Central Strike Committee, the Publicity Committee, the Social Committee, and the Canvassing Committee. The social committee is going to put out a big call for help. There will be dances to raise funds. Coffee must be made. Sandwiches must be made. Entertainers are needed. The morale on the picket line is high. Keep it high. It is possible to get a sound truck. Take your turn on that sound truck. Start a little singing. Let the boys know that you are with them. Every picket line must have a coffee canteen. For a coffee canteen at any of the mills, it would take at least three women each shift. These canteens must be established at once. It is important and necessary work. The canvassing committee needs all your help. We need food, sugar, and coffee for our canteens. Every grocery store must be canvassed. Every dairy, bakery, pharmacist. We need money. Our strike fund won't last forever. This is an auxiliary job. Canvas for money support, give socials, approach sympathetic organizations and clubs. The auxiliary membership as it stands now cannot possibly handle all this work. Get behind your union and join your auxiliary. Organize and have some fun as well. I think one of the things that struck me about reading this article is that they couldn't conceive of it being three people are needed on the coffee line at the canteen, you know? Three women are needed for every coffee canteen. It's right. What? Just because it was so clearly, I don't think that you'd read that in a union newsletter now, for example. Yeah, it's too much of an assumption that it's women who have to do that kind of work, and that the really important work is the work of being on the picket line. I find it very contradictory because they're saying that the women who are in the union have to be released for the important work of picketing, right? So women auxiliary members have got to take on the role of providing coffee service, and then, in order to make women want to do that at the end, they say this is important and necessary work. Right? So there's a lot of contradictions built in there. I think, in the way that women are looked at and women's role is looked at. There's articles on the Auxiliary Convention endorsing the IWA demands, and also women from the IWA participated in an International Women's Day meeting, and they reported on the history of the of International Women's Day and some of the issues facing union women right now. Here's a brief quote. Women of the world must learn to learn what is going on. We must study the newspapers' newsreels. We must face the fact that our problems are not separate and apart from those of the rest of humanity. This was the theme of the gripping talk given at the International Women's Day meeting in Vancouver, March 8th, by Annie Buller, manager of the Canadian Tribune and veteran labor leader. Right, yeah. So that another little piece of unknown history is that there were International Women's Day celebrations, you know, during the 30s and the 40s in British Columbia. Okay. In 1947, they organized a buyer's strike, and the strike plans included the following calendar. May 10th to 17th, buy no butter, lard, or shortening. May 17th to 24th, buy no jam, marmalade, peanut butter, or canned fruit. The third and fourth weeks of the strike, May 24th to June 10th, will include items suggested by the Housewives Association as closely as possible. Proposed ways of carrying out the strike plans include sponsoring of public protest meetings with other local unions and other organizations in the community, urging of IWA District Council and local unions to actively participate in the buyer's strike, appealing to farmers' groups and other organizations to form strong consumers' movements, to cooperate with the Housewives Association, using paid advertisements, posters, leaflets, picketing, and every available means to advertise the buyer's strike, seeking cooperation of local merchants. The delegates also fully endorsed the children's chocolate bar strike and promised any help that might be necessary to ensure its success. Quote, inasmuch as the excessive profits of the large distributors are sufficient proof that the primary producers could have an increased price for their products without a rise in cost to the consumer, the District Council of the IWA Auxiliaries goes on record, they go on record to support the buyer's strike. And then women were also quoted. The article goes on to talk about other union demands, and they talked about why women should support the 40-hour work week in the industry. And here's a quote from one woman in the auxiliary. What with traveling time and other preparations, more than 40 hours are put in every week anyway, and every working man and working woman is entitled to work not more than 40 hours in any one week. I didn't just marry a meal ticket from one of the Vancouver sisters, and that's about what it amounts to if my husband works more than 40 hours a week. We just never see our husbands when they work such long hours. Here's the way another one put it. Quote, wives often need a shorter work week, and the only way most of us can get it is if our husbands pitch in at home to give us a break, spend a little time with the children, and incidentally learn a bit of housekeeping. The unanimous opinion of delegates was that the union's fight for the 40-hour week was commendable and must be carried on and be included in the 1947 union program. Okay, and then here we are in 1948, and one of the central leaders of the IWA wrote an article arguing that union men should support the auxiliaries. And he said, Anytime a member of the IWA tries to dismiss lightly the work being done by our IWA auxiliaries, stop him right there and tell him to think again. Better still, get him to attend one of the auxiliary meetings and find out for himself just what's being accomplished. I did that last week in Nanaimo as a fraternal delegate from IWA Local 171 to the 6th Annual Convention, blah, blah, blah. I found out what was being done and I'm mightily impressed. The still prevailing idea that the auxiliaries exist mainly as caterers to social events should be discarded now and for all time, for our sister organization has come of age. You can see that this is a time when Margaret Mead was popular. Coming of age in Samoa. Maybe my opinion is not good enough. If so, let the record speak for itself. Consider for a moment the annual report of Auxiliary Local 99 of Campbell River. Functioning under the most difficult of conditions, it sometimes costs its auxiliary as high as $14 in taxi fares to bring the members over bad roads to the meeting place. Local 99 has raised the startling sum of $2,344 during the year of 1947, all of it from social functions. In terms of sheer hard work, after home duties have been taken care of, that amount is little short of staggering. In 1948, the women were organizing against the sales tax, the introduction of sales taxes. And that was another major campaign that they took up. So there was that issue, and they, rather than introduce a sales tax, the women wanted the government to assume a greater proportion of education costs, leaving less to be borne by ratepayers. The large share of education costs is now being borne by working people and farmers, while wealthy corporations like the CPR contribute little or nothing. And they also argued for money to be sent to medical research. In particular, cancer research was a really big issue at this time. That's enough. So do you have a kind of sense of what they were like, the auxiliaries, at all? And the kind of role that they played. It was broader, I think, than just a social organization for women. Yeah, this is the IWA, but the mine and mill auxiliaries were quite similar, actually. They were directly involved in the kind of political fights that went on within that union. And this is similar to the IWA. I'll play some taped material where women talk about the different political arguments inside the IWA. But the mine mill, one of the roles that the women played there was they would watch out for organizers coming up from the States, and they felt that they could get away with kind of following these guys around, and they would kind of dog them and send these fairly detailed accounts of what kind of organizing work right-wing delegates coming up to the from the U.S. were doing in B.C. to try and break the mine and mill union. And this is like 48, 49, 50 that these women are doing that. Kind of interesting. And the mine mill constitution for the auxiliary said, quote, "We hold that there is a class struggle in society, that this will continue until the producer is recognized as the sole master of his production. Only the working class can achieve emancipation." And then it goes on to argue for support for industrial unions and that if women broke that support for the class struggle, that they could be tried and thrown out of the auxiliary. Oh, if a woman's husband if a woman's husband joined management and she was a member of the mine mill, she lost her vote in mine mill, but she could still be a member of the auxiliary because the women recognized that it wasn't her fault that her husband joined management. And that she still might be a pro-union woman. They just didn't want her to be able to vote and influence policy. The auxiliary? The IWA one? It existed all the way up to, in Ontario until the early 60s when the union was broken by the steelworkers. And There was still a local of the mine mill and smelter workers in BC until I think the 70s. Trail, yeah, and then it became Kamaw. Yeah. And I imagine when they became Kamaw, they would have... Well, I think the auxiliaries kind of died before that. My sense of the auxiliary movement is by the mid-50s, they were gone. And then the only union where there was one that remained was the Fishermen's Union, and it was really a social group and played the role of a social group and still does to some extent. Although in this period of the 40s, it was a fairly politicized auxiliary, like the IWA also. Yeah, mid-50s. Well, in the IWA, what happened was that when the communists led the split and formed the Woodworkers Industrial Union of Canada, which was the breakaway, they set up auxiliaries. And what did you read about that? They set up a whole auxiliary structure. And the IWA continued to allow women to meet in auxiliaries, but they centralized them. And they did away with the sub-local structure where women were meeting on a really local basis. And because of that, the auxiliaries died very quickly because the women just simply could not leave their kids at home and travel to Duncan or wherever. And they were really threatened by the kind of role that the auxiliaries had played within the split.